This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with the Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Oh boy, coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, and it is glorious here. If you don't live here, you should. Oh, wow, this is exciting. I have a wonderful day today, and I'm starting with Mark Greeny. Is he on?
I am on. Hi, how are you doing, Patsy?
Oh, what am I going to do with you? What am I going to do with you? This is one hefty book. I tell you this. This is amazing. This book is big, and it's you get your value in this book. A bang for your buck is that's an expression people can use when they're talking about your books in general. But boy, with this one, oh, we get a bang for our buck.
Yeah, I don't get paid by the word, so I don't know why I do it, but I do write 150,000-160,000 word books.
Well, and
I like to tell.
And we love every word. And I'll tell you something. It's funny. I was trying to think, how does this book make me feel? You know, there must be an expression I can use. And then I thought, giddy with delight. I mean, it's not often that a thriller makes a person absolutely giddy with delight, but this book is so good. And I want to say chapters 46 and 47, I mean, they are classics. They are going to be, I think people are going to study them in, you know, in all those MFA courses they take, how to write a thriller, and they're going to use your chapter 46 and 47.
Oh, well, that's good to know. I don't even know what's on those chapters.
Well, I'll just give you a hint. Let's just say you put a new spin on the Frisbee.
Okay, yeah.
You know what chapter I'm talking about. Oh, boy. I'm not giving it away to people. They have to, they'll enjoy the ride up to then. And then when they get on that, those two chapters, they'll say, oh, my goodness, Mark is just going to make us all go giddy with delight. How about that?
I'll take it. That's great.
Wow. I don't know, Mark. It's just, you know, of course, it's a 10th book in I didn't even say the name of the book. The name of the book is Relentless. People, and never has a book been more aptly titled than this book, Relentless, because you are relentless in this book.
Yeah, it's a big, crazy story, and it's got spies and assassins and mercenaries and terrorists and freedom fighters and a lot of politics, a lot of espionage, and hopefully it's a fun ride.
Oh, it is a fun ride. It is. It is like, it's in a way, it's like riding a Bronco. You're going up and down, and you get all these thrills. And then you get to chapters 46 and 47, and you're like, for a minute, that Bronco's kicking you up there in the air, and you're flying, and you say, oh, my goodness, what am I going to do? It's just wonderful. Beautifully written.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
You know, it's such a thrill. You know, sometimes I think to myself, my goodness, now I know, and according to your official biography, that you were everybody was something before they started writing, and you were a bartender. Now, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if this was just a cover story, and if you were actually, this might just be one of your cover stories. Were you really a bartender for years and years?
Yeah, that was one thing that I did. I usually worked a couple of jobs, but nothing very, very exciting. I worked in international business as well, in the medical device industry, and I was always sort of writing in my spare time. And, you know, I started writing my first book when I was 20, and I didn't get published till I was 42, but that's really nobody's fault but mine, because I was just not finishing things. I was just sort of picking at things. And once I got serious with it, then it came together, and I quit my day job, and I've been writing for 12 years now.
Well, it's certainly, it's so funny. It's hard to, I'm trying to think of you as working behind, now if I ever go back to a bar, nobody's going to bars, if I go back to a bar, and I'm going to look at that bartender, and I'm going to say, are you the next Mark Greeny? Do you have a gray man in you? It's
you never know.
You never know. Did you know back then? I mean, what was a favorite drink for you to mix? What was your best one?
Gosh, I was really good at martinis. I worked in more kind of semi-upscale bistro-y type places, so it wasn't, you know, the crazy, you know, bar drinks and stuff like that. But I was good at martinis. I'm still good at martinis.
Well, the funny thing is the gray man really doesn't care for martinis. He's no James Bond. He wants a good beer.
Yeah, exactly. He's the opposite of James Bond in a lot of regards, you know.
Well, let's talk about this wonderful, wonderful character, because it is, you know, he is a legend, even among thriller writers. Everybody, you know, I talk to so many thriller writers, and, you know, one of them, of course, is Jerome Preisler, and again, related to the whole Clancy wonderful years that that you've worked with Clancy, and then of course he's taken on some Clancy too. But everybody always talks about the gray man.
Well, that's nice to hear that they are.
So tell us about how you came out with this character.
Oh gosh. So I was, I'd written a couple of books and finally got in front of an agent, back in 2006, I think. And he looked at a book that I wrote, and he said, you know, this is really good writing, but the story's not really something that I think I can sell. He's like, but if you have a character with, like, sort of a lone hero type of thing and turn in an action novel like that, it would probably work. And so about that time, I was down in El Salvador doing some research. I mean, doing some Spanish study, because I worked in international business. I was just studying Spanish in Guatemala. And I was down in El Salvador, and I was just sitting in a bar one night, and I saw this guy that was American, very sort of interesting looking. And just as I sat there having a beer, I just created an entire backstory for him, not even thinking about writing a book, just daydreaming, I guess. And then I made him like former CIA, but the CIA was trying to hunt him down. So he's living in El Salvador, or, you know, in off grid. And the next morning I was like, well, there's your book. There's your character. You know, you need to come up with a book about it. It still took a couple more years before I got published, but that's when I came up with him.
Wow. Wow. And you certainly did. Now one of the features, of course, in your book, you have a lot of weapons, and everybody's got a weapon in your book. It's so funny. I don't think, you know, everybody's got a gun somewhere on their body. Of course, you have learned along the way. I don't know if during your bartender days you were carrying concealed weapon, but since then you've had to learn a lot about guns in order to keep up with things.
Yeah. When I was writing in the 2000s, before I was published, I started taking courses with firearms just to kind of learn a little bit more about it, and I got really interested in it and own a bunch of the weapons. And then I continue to take these courses, and it's really more than the equipment and the technology. It's the people that you meet in the bunkhouse when you, or the team room or whatever, who are special forces or SWAT or this or that. I've learned a lot that's informed my books just by going to these classes and spending 2 days or a week or something shooting with the guys that do this for a living.
Well, and it is fun. And I have to ask you, let me see which one. Do you like the Glock 19 or the Makarov 9? The Steyr 9, I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. So I've actually never shot the Steyr. It has a cool name, so that's why it goes in my book.
Yeah.
But I'm a Glock 19 fan. I have a couple of Glock 19s, and I do have a Makarov as well. But the Glock 19 is kind of my go-to gun. It's really, for the character, it makes sense, because it's a very simple, efficient, no glam. You know, it's not a sexy gun for gun people at all. It's literally just like a brick that shoots bullets. And that just sort of, it's sort of like my character. He's not fancy.
Yeah, well, I like it too. I thought that was a good choice. Although I will tell you, the Steyr 9 is pretty good. Although the grip is a little bit different. I'm somebody who slept with a Uzi under my bed for 40 years.
Wow.
So my husband is Israeli. So I know these guns, and so it's fun actually reading your books, and when you're talking about weapons, I particularly enjoy that part.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, you try not to put too much in there to slow the story down, but you really want to add to the verisimilitude of the story and show the details that are relevant. So it's an aspect. You know, I learned how to scuba dive because I write about scuba diving, and I took stunt driving courses because I wanted to learn about defensive driving and all that. And, you know, there's a limited amount of time. I've written two books a year for 10 years, so I don't get to do stuff like that as much as I would like, but at the same time, it really does help the writing.
And lends it authenticity. And, of course, meanwhile, you're making all these wonderful connections with people who have been out there in the field and right. give you, I think, a good perspective on the situation.
Yeah, and it's really helped me a lot. And then working with Tom Clancy opened a lot of doors for me. I've had a lot of good fortune since I've become published to really have doors open for me, so I can learn a bit about these things that I wouldn't know anything about otherwise.
Well, I mean, now you didn't. How did you learn to write so well? I mean, you are really good. So when it came to time for Clancy to pick somebody to work with, that he picked you. I mean, it absolutely means that you're an extraordinary writer.
Well, thank you for saying that. I really feel like I learned my chops in writing by failing and sort of falling on my face a little bit. I spent 15 years writing my first book, and then I wrote my second book in 7 months. Because, like, once you've done it, you're like, okay, really, how much time was I actually working? And, you know, I enjoy writing. So I think I learned a lot just from reading novels and then just trying stuff out. And, you know, I dealt with all the rejection that a lot of published authors dealt with for a few years. And then I got my foot in the door with Gray Man. That book came out, and I just finished the third book in the series when I was asked. My agent called me and said that, you know, asked if I was interested in writing in the Jack Ryan books with Tom. So that was a quantum leap. I was a paperback author at that point that was about to go into the big leagues, and I knew it.
And we're talking big leagues once you took over Jack Ryan.
Yeah, I did three books with Tom before he passed away. And then the family hired me to continue writing the series, so I did four more. So I did seven Jack Ryan books in a 6-year period. So it was a very intense time because I was also writing Gray Man books at the same time. But I wouldn't trade it for the world.
Well, so now you definitely are focused. You have to be a very focused writer to put such great product out. And it is a product, you know, a book is a product, and you have to really work at it. And sometimes people don't realize how very, very hard it is to write something, you know, at this length. Is how many pages? 512 pages. It's a big book. What's your day like then?
Well, it's funny, you know, I have two deadlines a year because I write two books a year, I have written two books a year. And my day changes as I get closer and closer to deadline. I get more and more serious. So it's funny. Right now, I'm getting close to a June deadline, and I'm in a good shape. I'm writing book 11 in the series now, but at the same time, I was up working at 6:45 this morning, and I'm doing some media stuff today as well. And I'll go back to work and back and forth. But I'm a morning writer. I got married in September, and my wife has three children, so I have three stepchildren now. So I'm learning about carpool later in life than a lot of people are. So there's some days where I get up around 6 a.m., and I'm like, I really can't get started till 8 because it would be very rude to drop the kids off at school an hour and a half early. So my day's starting a little bit later these days, but I just work a little bit longer.
Well, and definitely you have to get really into this character. The way that you write, as you're writing about the Gray Man, and there's so many twists and turns in this book. There are so and wonderful characters, the love interest, his friends, his enemies. You write a good enemy, I can tell you.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, you know, that's always been interesting to me to put as much into the villains as you do into the heroes. You don't want the villains just to be the guy with the curved mustache and the black hat. You want his or her motivation to make sense to them. You don't want the reader rooting for the bad guys, but at the same time, you want to believe that the bad guys are doing what they, you know, what they're doing. Everybody's the hero of their own story, even if you're the villain.
Yeah, and in this case, the villain. Well, let's just say he is pretty amazing, and we can let's just say we'll fly with that one, okay?
Yeah. There's a couple of villains in this one, but the main one is a guy from the United Arab Emirates, and he has sort of like a big global plan to pull the United States into war for his own aims, and that's what starts this kind of globe-trotting search for missing intelligence officers around the world. And the hero, Cord Gentry, who we mentioned, is basically pulled out of a CIA medical ward. He's injured, and they need him more than they need him to get healthy. And
well,
into this hunt,
you know, Courtney, his real name is Courtney Gentry, and it sounds like he should be a very sort of noble British guy. But he's so American and just so great, and no fancy drinks for him, just or fancy clothes either. I don't think he likes fancy clothes. Just a wonderful, wonderful character. And I must say, I will add that the doctor that you've introduced here, wonderful, just wonderful, beautifully written. And I have my fingers crossed that I'm going to hear more about her in future books, because I thought she was just a wonderful character. And this is what's exciting, isn't it? Sometimes when you're writing, these characters just come to you.
Yeah, the doctor you speak of, Dr. Kaya, she's a Turkish woman who works in Berlin, and Court just needs some help, and he knows of her from his past, and he goes to seek her out to get some help to keep him in the fight. And, you know, she was, like a lot of characters when you write these books, she was a character that I initially came up with because she satisfied a role that I needed in the story, and I didn't really have any thoughts on her personality or anything. She was just kind of like a chess piece on the board. And then as you start to write her and do a little research on these people, she just really fleshed out, and she was a fun character to write, and it made her more important in the story. I started to like her and add her into the story more, so I think she'll be back.
Oh, I hope so, because it is like that. Sometimes where a character, like in this case, she just wants to come out there. She just wants to be part of that. And the reader, as a reader, you meet her, and you really literally feel like you meet her, that you know her, and you want to know more about her. And I was delighted. That's why I say it's rare that, you know, a thriller will make somebody absolutely giddy with delight. But I think she was one of the reasons why I got this feeling that I was so thrilled with this thriller, and because you fleshed her out and some of the other characters too, it's just a great book. Everyone, the name of the book is Relentless, and really, as I said, this title is so perfect for this story, because Court Gentry is relentless, and he's not going to give up. And all of the, of course, all the political aspects of it, the you know, this takes place in Berlin, which is an exciting city in and of itself. And then all of the things that happen between the Iranians and the Arabs and all of this, you weave all that story in nicely. And I hope that people will read it and take more interest in actually the politics and understand a little bit more about what Iran means, and what you know, the difference between Iran and the Arabs, because sometimes people don't understand this dynamics of the Middle East.
Yeah, so every time I write a book, just as you said before, it's a product and it's entertainment, and so I don't ever want to preach or anything like that. But I, as I do my research, I get really, really passionate about whatever subject it is that I'm writing about. So I do hope, you know, that as people read it, they might learn things, or it just might make them curious about things, no matter what the subject matter.
Exactly. And I think it will. And I that's one of the many reasons that people should be reading this book. And as you said, you know, it's now that you're writing two books a year, And it's so exciting. Tell us about getting the first, you're going to get the Gray Man into production here.
Oh, the film, yeah.
The film.
Yeah, they're actually filming it right now. In my first book, which was just called The Gray Man, that came out in 2009, has been optioned by a couple of studios and the Russo brothers, who wrote the Captain America Winter Soldier, directed Winter Soldier and Endgame and Infinity War. They wrote the screenplay for this, and they're directing it right now, and Court Gentry is going to be played, or is being played, by Ryan Gosling.
Wow.
And the villain in the first book is a guy named Lloyd, and he's being played by Chris Evans, and Billy Bob Thornton is in there. And there's a really nice cast, and they're filming in Los Angeles right now, and then they'll go to Europe and film into the summer.
Well, that's exciting, and we need it. We need a new character, and we need a new a whole new series, and it's so nice. You're up to book 10. Well, you're working on book 11, so we have a lot of movies to look forward to.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, from the very beginning, they've been talking about hopefully making this a franchise, and we'll see how the first one goes, but that's pretty exciting to think of.
Well, I think it's going to go, because I think the character's great, your writing's great, and as I said, you've developed a whole sort of group of people that go along with Courtney, and I think that I'm looking forward to the film, but I'm always, of course, for me, it's the book that counts, and Relentless is a fantastic book, and I know that you're on a big PR tour. Is it, you know, that's still, even for somebody as famous as you, it's part of being an author, of going out there and just finding more readers.
Yeah, and you always want people to read your books, and it becomes, you know, a passion of yours, is to kind of get the word out and have people, you know, try them out and see what they think. And so, I hope your listeners will give this series a chance.
Well, I'm going to be relentless about pushing this book. I'm going to talk about it for months, because I think it's a great book. And all for everyone I know who is writing, they have to especially read 46 and 47. Those chapters are just going to be classics, and they'll be taught in college courses for years to come. And, you know, Mark Greeny, I want to thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper. What's your website? What is it?
It is my name. It's markgreenybooks.com. So it's Greeny books.
And it's Greeny. You like it's pronounced Greeny. When I pronounce it Greeny.
That's okay. I don't even notice one way or the other, because it's about 50-50 how people.
At first, when I first got your book, I was calling you Greenery. So it's Greeny. We'll pronounce it correctly. Mark Greeny has written this fantastic book called Relentless, because he's a relentless writer. And I want to thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today, Mark.
Thank you so much for having me, Patsy.
Okay. Well, I'll have you back soon, because you keep writing them, okay?
Okay.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Mark Greeny. Wow. I'm telling you, this book is big. It's fat. It's thick. It could stop a bullet, maybe. You know, I think it could, probably. It would at least slow it down. And you get... I tell you, it's worth every buck, and it's really a good read. So very, very exciting. And then, you know, it's funny. Today, I have a busy day, because I wanted to... I'm having a problem. I want to talk to everybody. I get so many wonderful books. And it's hard for me to say no, especially when I get a book that really is quite amazing. And something that I really think that you should read. And so I just want to turn... I'm not going to do commercials. We're not going to do commercials today, Big Ed. If our guest is on. Is my next guest on? No, he's not on. Well, then I might do one. Let's do one commercial. And wait for this.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my next guest, a very, very special person. When I read this book, I was actually in tears at some points, and then at other points, I was just smiling so much, and it's really an honor to welcome to the Joy on Paper, Ed Hagem, and the name of the book is On the Road Less Traveled, An Unlikely Journey from the Orphanage to the Boardroom. And I am so, so very honored to have you on the program. Hello, Ed.
Hello, Patsy. Thank you very much. You're very kind in your comments of both crying and smiling. I've heard that a number of times now. I guess I did the same thing.
Well, you know, I got very emotional at several points in the book because the thought of what you went through as a child was just so heartrending, but then the thought of what you did and all of the wonderful things that you have done in your life. And so I wanted to, you know, take just a moment to say that, first of all, the Audible version, people listen to the Audible version, it is quite amazing. It is.
Oh no, Bob Shapiro did a fabulous job of capturing my voice, and I'm listening to it for the third time now. It really is very. He's done just a great job.
He has, and I actually, I like to have narrators on the program, and I would actually like him to come back with you one day, and he can read some parts of it. Because I think it's very important that people hear those words come out of his mouth, because they're your words, but he's captured, as you say.
He actually interviewed 10 different narrators. He's done 50 books, and the coincidence is his father and I are about the same age, and you know, just one coincidence after another. It turns out when his father married his mother owned a 1964 Valiant. When I married my wife, she owned a 1964 Plymouth Valiant.
Wow.
A lot of coincidences. And he loved the book, and that was the most important thing.
Well, I think that comes through in the narration. It is really one of the very, very best narrations I've ever heard.
And this Mary Woolrich, who is the woman who does Audible books, was fantastic. I mean, I read the preface, and it took me 2 hours. She wouldn't let me swallow one word or miss one word. She was just very good. She did the same thing with Bob.
Well, you know, let's start not at the beginning of what happened to you, but let's just start at that moment when you and your wife were getting ready to go to the Smithsonian. And there you are in Washington, D.C. Tell us why you were there. Explain to my listeners why you were there and why you guys decided to go to the Smithsonian and what was there that was amazing.
Well, I had hid my background for all of my life. Since I was 18 years old, I buried my background. And at this point in time, I was going that evening, I was going to receive the Horatio Alger Award, and they had done a video of my past background, and it was going to be displayed to over 1,200 people, so I was about as nervous as a cat. And so Barbara noticed that, and I'd known that the Smithsonian had a fabulous transportation exhibit, so we walked from the hotel over to the Smithsonian, and we walked into the transportation exhibit, and the first big exhibit, as you walked right in, was a 1930s Ford Roadster, and in back of that Roadster was a map showing a big black line from St. Louis to Los Angeles. And, of course, that was the trip that I took when my father kidnapped me from my mother in St. Louis. We drove from St. Louis to Los Angeles along Highway 66. Took 3 or 4 days. And, you know, and that little Roadster didn't make too much speed. But I just stood there and I just froze when I looked at it. And it brought back all kinds of memories of, you know, things that I didn't know that I knew. And it was quite an experience. And it was a flashback that, you know, I stood there. I must have stood there for 15 minutes. Barbara said, what's the matter? I said, this is crazy. This can't happen. And sure enough, there it was.
Well, that's, what are the odds that that would happen? You know, this is one of the miracles sometimes of life. All of these golden threads that connect us and connect us to events. Things that happen that are really inexplicable, but that at that moment you should walk there and you should see that map and it all comes back to you. And, you know, not many people have been kidnapped. So tell us about how this happened and why did your father kidnap you?
My father, you know, and mother didn't get along. There's a lot of reasons. It's all in the book. He had lost everything in 29 through 33, and basically, you know, once you do that, you lose everything. You have demons that nobody understands. Anyway, he was a very difficult character to get along with, and she divorced him, which is very unusual in 1939 for a 24-year-old woman to get divorced at all. She went home, and she was not welcomed at home. She was one of six siblings, and in 1939, no one needed to have anybody return home with a crying baby. My father decided that he had Sunday visiting rights, and he decided he couldn't live without me. So he drove from Los Angeles to San Francisco to St. Louis, picked me up, found me "quote unquote" unkept. That was his statement. And instead of taking me to the movies or taking me to the playground, he got back on Highway 66 and drove back to Los Angeles. And I think the simple way to say it is, he was feeling and not thinking about what he was doing, taking a child he had to take care of. My mother, in giving me up, was not feeling and thinking. She basically felt that, given the fact that she was not welcome at home, that I might be better off with my father. And so my father took him back to Los Angeles, and in a short period of time after, he told me that I'd never see my mother again, that she passed away, and that's what I lived with for 57 years. That she had basically died, you know, that year in 1939. But he, you know, he loved me beyond anything else. I was the most important thing in his life, and he couldn't live without me. On the other hand, you know, given his job, which was a radio operator aboard a merchant vessel, being a merchant marine, he was, you know, out of pocket 9 out of 12 months a year or more. And so, and when the war came in 1941, he had to give me up completely, went into the service full-time, and for 4.5 years I didn't see him. So, and that went on.
And so you spent part of your time in orphanages?
Well, no, as the war started, he put me into Catholic foster homes. We were Jewish, but he felt the Catholic welfare system was better than anything else in Los Angeles. Since I was born in a Catholic hospital, he was able, I don't know how he did it, he convinced the Catholic Welfare Agency, not telling him that we were Jewish, told him we were Catholic, and I ended up in 5 Catholic foster homes from 1942 to 1946. My report card said that they thought I was a smart young man, but I was so mischievous they couldn't tell. So I guess I was a handful. And the foster homes varied. The first one was awful, cold, uncaring, and actually abusive, to the last one, which was warm, caring, and you know, really showed me what a family was like. And then after the war, my father came back on the East Coast rather than the West Coast. He was transferred. I flew across country. I don't know how he got me across. I flew across country alone. It was a five-stopper, you know, Oklahoma City, Denver, St. Louis, Chicago, and finally New York, 20 hours. And we spent the summer of 46 in the Sloan House in 34th Street in New York City, and then Coney Island in a one-and-a-half-bedroom apartment where I went to FIES 106. Unfortunately, Dad couldn't find any land-based occupation, so we had to go back to sea, and I ended up in two Jewish orphanages, one in Far Rockaway until I was 14, until I aged out of that one, and then finally one in Yonkers, New York, at Roosevelt High School, until I graduated from high school. So I spent, you know, in about 15 or 20 different places between my first 18 years, and people say, how horrible. Well, yes, it's horrible. It's a great disadvantage, but it gave me one great advantage. After that period of time, I was very adaptable. I gained the capability of adaptability. You know, I could adapt to almost anything after that particular period of time. In fact, one of my friends says, well, if you go to more than one public school, you learn the rites of passage, and you learn how to get from one place to the other. And I guess I did that five times. So,
wow. You know, your story is so big. And as I said, the audible version is so compelling. I really want to bring you back, if you don't mind. I'd like to bring you back with the narrator. And I would like to... There's so much in this book. When I got the book, I mean, I get a lot of books, you know, and sometimes I can cover them faster. But with this book, one, I got very emotional as I'm reading it. Two, the inspiration that you can, I think, give to people that they can overcome. I mean, if you could overcome this, and I know people who have, you know, fewer problems in their lives, and they still can't overcome things that, you know, happened 40, 50 years ago. Perhaps their mothers yelled at them one time, and I say sometimes to people, well, get over it, you know, get on with your life.
You've got the essence of it. And by the way, the reason I'm going forward with this is I'm finding there's a body of young people, underprivileged backgrounds, that I can help get through the difficult period. The book says very simply, anything is possible. Education is the most important thing. And if you can find a partner for life, find a partner for life. It's the most important thing. And then find out who you are. And then people say to me, how did you get out of that? The real secret is never be a victim. No matter what happens to you, go forward. Don't blame anybody. Just go forward. Take whatever you're given. And by the way, if you look at my life, which is really humorous, some of the worst things that happened to me subsequently was actually a gift. I always say, you know, if you fail early, it's a gift. And if you fail certain times in life, you know, it actually works out extremely well. I mean, I got thrown out of Lehman Brothers after doing everything right. People said, one young man asked me the other night, you know, what's the worst thing? What did you have to get over? I said, when you do everything right for a period of a year, for 7 years, I was a stellar employee. I changed divisions. I hired the right people. But it ended up me being basically thrown out. And then I got my dream job, which was to run a small investment bank for the next 20 years. Being rejected at a country club, which I was, and then having to build my own golf course was one of the greatest experiences of my life.
Well,
I wasn't rejected. You know, if I became a victim, it's, these people are terrible, so on, blah, blah, blah. No, I didn't think a minute. I just went on to the next step. And then my business is the same way. Never be a victim.
Ed, you know, I can't do justice today. I don't have enough time today to talk about everything I want to talk to you about. Will you come back? I'll contact you after this program. I'm going to sort of switch my calendar around, and I'll find a day within the next few weeks that you can come on and you can be here for most of the hour so that we can go through more details and more of your inspirational ideas. Will that work out for you?
You know, you've been so kind already. You're going to have as much time as you'd like. I mean, what I feel very, very fortunate to is that people like you are reading the book and it resonates with them. And that really t- tells me that I did the right thing, because I was not going to do this. I was going
to... Well, that's one of the reasons I need you back. I need to spend a good 45 minutes with you. So I'm going to contact you after this program today. I'll give you a date, and you're going to come back here, and we're going to really sort of hunker down and talk about how you can inspire my listeners and so many people with this wonderful book, okay?
Thank you. Sure.
Okay.
Glad to do it.
You'll be back soon. All right.
All right.
Thank you very much. Ed, hey, Jim.
Day.
And meanwhile, people, you can get this book now. It's called On the Road, Less Traveled, An Unlikely Journey from the Orphanage to the Boardroom. And Ed is going to be back soon so we can talk more about it. Okay, Ed?
Yep. Looking forward to it. Patsy, take good care.
Okay, great. Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
I like this guy. And I tell you, the book is amazing, really amazing. And I've just been so lucky. I've gotten some, you know, sometimes you just get one book after another that's fantastic. And this next book I'm going to talk about today, it has a cute title, Watercress. And you think, watercress? What is watercress? But it is a beautiful, beautiful, it's a picture book, and it's just gorgeous. And I'm so happy to welcome, do I have both of you on today, Andrea Wang?
Yes, hi, Kathy.
Okay, and Jason, is Jason on too?
I am, thanks for having us.
Oh, well, I want to thank you both for being on today, because Andrea, this story is beautiful. And Jason, wow, what an illustrator. You are amazing.
Thank you.
Wow, beautiful, beautiful illustrations. You capture the American Midwest. You know, I'm from northern Michigan. And when I saw all of these lovely, lovely illustrations, I thought, oh, wow, it's just wonderful how you captured it.
Oh, thank you. I spent some time in Lansing, Michigan. So I have memories of the landscape.
Well, and of course, you have won, you know, quite a few awards. I know that you, I don't remember all of them, but a lot, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So
I've been very fortunate.
It's talent. And then, Andrea, you know, this story, Watercress, tell us about it, because I'll tell you, it really particularly hit me because of something in my past. So you tell us about this wonderful story that you wrote.
Oh, sure. Watercress is the story of a young girl whose Chinese immigrant parents make her pick watercress by the side of the road. And she's super embarrassed about this, until her mother shares a story from her own childhood growing up in China during the famine. And so this girl's shame turns to, you know, a deeper understanding and appreciation of her heritage. And it is based on a memory I have of picking watercress by the side of the road growing up in rural Ohio, and my feelings about that and how I processed that experience.
Well, it's beautifully told, and it's, you know, one of these stories, and I think it's wonderful to be able to share this type of thing so that people will say, well, yeah, look at my heritage. It's really great. It's really wonderful, and, and you know, something like that, the beautiful story about, you know, just stopping along the road and picking that watercress and knowing that behind it, there's this marvelous story that links you to your ancestors, to your past, but still a very American story, too.
Yes, I think that the themes in it are universal, and the experiences, too. Both Jason and I have been hearing from people who have read the book from all over the country, and they're telling us about their stories of picking food from the wild and their relationship to it.
Well, I have to tell you mine, because my grandmother came from Finland to northern Michigan. And I had a similar event with her. She picked thimbleberries. Now, they're not very popular with most people, but Finns love thimbleberry jam. And my grandmother spoke Finnish. she never spoke English ever to anyone in the family except me. She would not, people always thought she could not speak English. She actually, she would go with the family to the cinema, to the movies, and she could speak English perfectly. But she deliberately would never speak. She was always, her heart was always in Finland with those thimbleberries that she picked as a child. And so when I read this story, Watercress, I got tears in my eyes thinking about her and about those thimbleberries and about her life. You know, she loved America, but what it was always there that Finland was where her heart was.
Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Well, you know, this is what the
picture.
Tell us about how you got this, Jason. How you captured this wonderful feeling.
Well, when I illustrated this book, I tried to put myself in the shoes of all the characters in the book, and tried to understand what they were feeling and how they were feeling about this event of picking the watercress, and I tried to identify with the characters and reach back into my own past and remember times when I felt like I didn't belong or I was embarrassed by my parents, or put myself in the shoes of the older brother who's teasing the sister, because I was an older brother and I know I my brother sometimes. And so that's my method of getting into the story. But to parlay that into how I think this book, or why I think this book is important, is that I think parents and children, when they read this book together, will be able to have discussions, or I hope it will start discussions about family stories and build connections between parents and their children, or children and their parents, to understand their history.
I agree. It opens up conversations, and that's the wonderful thing about a book like this. I hadn't thought about my grandmother for many years, actually, you know, about that particular, that feeling that she got when she was picking those thimbleberries. And the same thing happens, I'm sure, to so many of the people who read this book, that things that from their childhood they remember suddenly. And I hope that many people will be inspired to write their own stories.
I hope so too.
But I don't know if anybody will find an illustrator as good as Jason, because Jason, really, you are terrific.
I was so fortunate. I'm so grateful for Jason to taking on this project, and it's been a real collaboration.
I want to echo that and say, you know, I did my part, but Andrea's text is outstanding, and it's been a collaboration between us and the editor and the art director and everyone at the publisher. The way this has come together, it's just, I'm so proud of this book, and I hope everyone gets a chance to check it out.
Well, I do too, and it's called Watercress, and of course it's available wherever books are sold. I hope that there are more bookstores open, because it will look just beautiful on the, you know, on the table right at the front of the store. People, all you bookstore owners, if you have a bookstore, put this book right at the front, because the minute you see this, the cover, you have to pick it up and you have to look at it, and you'll say, whoa, this illustrator, what an artist.
Absolutely. And I've had the pleasure of seeing Jason's painting of the cover in real life, because I purchased it from him, and it is even more luminous and stunning in real life.
Well, I'm sure it will make an absolutely lovely poster. You have to, now do you have a website that you want people to go to?
I do. My website is AndreaYWang.com, and you can find links to all my books and my social media accounts there.
And Jason?
And my website is jasonchin.net, my social media links are there as well.
Well, I think, I don't know if you're selling this as a poster, the cover, but it is a beautiful, beautiful cover. And I have a feeling you could sell some posters out of that cover.
we'll bring it up with our editor.
Well, you should, because that's, you know, again, that's a wonderful way to get more readers, and it's part of the whole marketing package. You have to keep out there, you know, always trying to market things, and when you have a cover like that that just grabs people's eyes right away, I think it would make a wonderful poster.
Well, we'll be sure to send you one if it is ever printed.
Well, I hope so. Okay. And again, I want to thank you both for being on. I hope maybe perhaps there's more collaboration in your future, because you're both prolific writers, and I'm sure you're full of wonderful stories to tell.
Oh, I hope so,
thank
too.
Thank you. I hope so, too.
Okay, well, we want to hear more definitely from you, Andrea, about more of your family stories, and you know, just keep us always interested and excited about learning. And if you do that with children, if you write these stories, children want to learn, children want to know more, and that's a wonderful thing about being an author for children, that you really can change lives.
Yes, that's one of the best things about it, is writing for the young people and trying to make them feel seen and understood.
And I hope that soon you will be able to do more events. I don't know if probably you're doing some Zoom stuff now, but I'm sure that you'll be more than welcome at various events, you know, wherever you can get out with children and do some reading for them, because they'll love this story.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I hope so, too.
Okay, and the name of the book is Watercress, and it's beautiful. It's a gorgeous book. Everybody, I want to thank Andrea and Jason so much for being on Joy on Paper today. It's been just wonderful talking to both of you.
It's been so lovely to be here, Patsy. Thank you for having us.
Okay, bye-bye now. Great, great
bye-bye.
Book. Okay, they are so nice, and this book is... Oh, really, it's so wonderful to find a book like this. I just hope that everybody will get that book. And if you have a child in your life, get it. If you don't have a child in your life, this is a perfect book to buy. You can buy it on Amazon and send it to a children's hospital. Whoa, what a wonderful thing to do. And just everybody, remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, perhaps a streaming video, or if you're very lucky, a whole series on the Hallmark Channel. And you never know, and you won't know unless you try, and that's what I'm hoping for Carol J. Perry, who's going to be a guest here, because she has a new book that's just come out. Oh, whoa, oh, whoa. And it's going to be so exciting to have her here in the studio. Meanwhile, say something nice to somebody. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Big Ed. Thank you so much. I can't talk anymore. He's got this whole place, and we have Eau de Clorox in here. Anyway, everybody, take care. Bye-bye now. See you on Thursday.